And it's time for episode 3 of our FinTech OG series. I'm super excited to have John Zainoff and Matthew Burton on the episode today. I will see John in a few weeks at the Empire FinTech Conference. I'm moderating a panel. I think it's around 3 in the afternoon on the 10th. You guys totally should go and then hit me up if you're there. I'd love to say hi. But anyway, so I ask John and Matt, who have both been in FinTech for, you know, a decade plus, about what they kind of expected over the past decade when they first got into the space, what they've done right, what they've done wrong, and where FinTech has added the most value and where they still think there's a lot of room for opportunity and where people should be keeping an eye on these days. So I'm super excited for you guys to listen in on this conversation. Please hit me up and let me know your thoughts. So I've known FS Vector from my early days in FinTech when I was a reporter at Bloomberg, trying to keep up on everything that was happening in the regulatory world with financial technology, which, spoiler alert, there's a lot going on all the time. Since then, they've been a staple in my conversations with a number of the companies that I work with, using them as a valuable resource for any consulting needs. FS Vector's advisory team has helped hundreds of companies launch financial products by advising on product structure, finding and establishing a relationship with a partner bank, and even standing up necessary compliance programs. In doing so, FS Vector felt that compliance and risk management training really didn't need to be a thing that employees detested, but something that they enjoyed doing. So that's why they recently went and built out their own training curriculum and a platform called Headmaster. Now, Headmaster is filled with relevant, accurate, and role-specific content specifically tailored to each FinTech's unique needs. It also provides timely regulatory updates and frequent tips on uplifting areas of compliance and risk management. So if you're looking to launch a new product and in need of compliance support, or you're just looking for a training platform, go to fsvector.com or click the link in the show notes for their contact information. John Zainoff, often dubbed the mayor of FinTech, has spent over 20 years building FinTech products, investing in early stage companies, and nurturing the startup community across North America. He is the founder of Empire Startups, the largest FinTech platform in the country, with over 100,000 wonderful FinTech nerds. John led investments in dozens of companies in his previous role, heading the FinTech program for Techstars, the Barclays Accelerator. He serves as a board member or mentor to countless FinTech startups, as a judge for FinTech competitions, and speaks globally on the evolving FinTech landscape. John's experience in FinTech started before the hashtag, leading product teams at BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, Instinet, and E-Trade. Matthew Burton has been an operator and investor for the last 15 years. Notable exits include Atomeld, sold to Google, LiveRail, sold to Facebook, and Orchard, sold to Cabbage and Amex. He was the pre-seed lead investor in Menu, Rain, Wayflyer, Fairplay, SimplyWise, and Cedar Money. Outside of work, Matt is an avid tennis and paddle player. Thanks so much for making this work out.
Thanks for having us.
John, where are you calling in from today? New York?
FinTech capital of the world, nowhere else.
That is debatable from some people, but I believe right now.
Sign me up.
You have to always say that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me, you guys. So this is part of the FinTech OG series that we're having here at TWIF. And I've been doing it in pairs, part of it because I love the whole radio show type style versus just me interviewing one person. Also partially because there were so many people I wanted to have on here, like great people in the FinTech space. And I was like, I can't do like 50 episodes. So here we are. How long have you guys known each other, by the way? I literally went through on LinkedIn and was like, okay, who have connections with who and who? Whereas other ones, some were obvious, like Frank Rotman and Nigel Morris were on an episode together. Jackie Reses and Max Levchin were on an episode together because I know that they know each other, but you guys were a little bit less obvious. So tell me how you guys know each other, actually.
I mean, it was prison was the first time, right? I was doing 8 to 10. Honestly, it wasn't me, but snitches get stitches. No, Matt and I grew up in the fintech community, and you know, one thing when you were talking about going out and doing OGs of fintech, the reality is every generation has their OGs of fintech, which is kind of funny. And you know, probably this is the closest to your Gen X segment, but you're going to do your Boomer segment, your Millennial segment, and your you know, Gen Z's investing in private companies before they have a 401k plan segment a little bit later on.
I think technically probably Nigel and Frank were the boomer segment. Don't tell them I said that though.
Yeah. They can't listen to this on their flip phone anyway, so it's going to be fine. And you know, we can dive into this, but that was the New York City fintech community circa 2010 to 2012. I mean, Matt will chime in, but he was at the helm of Orchard at the time, just on a rocket ship, and I was pulling nerds in the same room together, the same thing I do 15 years later.
I think what was so interesting was, like, at that time, there wasn't really that many events. I mean, maybe like 3 events per year, if you sort of don't count Money 2020, which was more of a payments conference, I feel like, at that time and just starting out. So it was a relatively small community in New York. You know, it's like, it always has shocked me how sort of big fintech has gotten over time, yeah. You know, just in terms of pure employment.
It's so really
all the nerds back then knew each other. Everyone knew everyone.
Everyone still kind of knows each other, though. Like, it's like fintech just keeps getting bigger, but it still feels super small in so many ways, which is what part of the reason I think all 3 of us are still in it and what I love about it. John, how did you first get into fintech? I know you do the event side and everything now, but what was events your first foray into it, or you know, what sort of got you into the space? And then Matt, I want you to answer the same question too.
I mean, God, no. I mean, good for the, I guess, hospitality majors that got into event planning straight out of school. I think I just wasn't that smart. I thought it was a good idea to go get a mechanical engineering and mechanics degrees, and I thought I was going to go design race cars actually growing up. But so there's like, how'd you get into financial services, I guess, or how did you get into tech? And then there's how do you get out of the fintech community, and those two are separate. So, you know, I kind of spoiled it, but I studied engineering and ended up being recruited by trading firms, surprisingly enough. I was either going to go work, go buy my first Silverado and go work out in Detroit, or I was going to come to a trading firm here in New York. But they recruited just, you know, as heavy as can be out of engineering schools. And at the time, this was, you know, when I was in school, it was the late 90s, the stock market was just going crazy. You know, everyone was making, you know, this was like the pre-GameStop. Everyone was getting super rich on beta investing just in anything to do with the internet. And so I was affected by that. And decided, you know what, I can always go back to engineering school, but I want to see, you know, what this is all about, what New York City is all about. And so my career started on the American Stock Exchange, running around, you know, one of those young, bright, type A idiots with a trading jacket, running around screaming at people. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't until years later, maybe 10 years later, that I decided, you know what, there's some amazing things happening outside of our walls, and you know, no one is thinking about technology and innovation after hours. Let me pull some of my favorite nerds together. And that's really how, originally it's called the New York FinTech Startups Meetup, NYFTS. I mean, those are the early days, just 40 nerds. I bought them the cheapest pizza I could possibly find. And, you know, that's how, that was my start more into the
You didn't
FinTech
pay
community.
For the pizza in Bitcoin back then though, right? You're good.
I mean, not only could I not pay with, you know, ETH, but it was an accounting firm hosted us. The accounting firm didn't know what fintech was. They didn't want to participate. They're like, you can use our conference room after 6:30, but none of our partners will still be in the building. I was like, would you, you know, throw in some pizza? And it was just like a hard no. Was it like, interesting, we'll see? They're just like, absolutely not. So that's where, in 2010, that's where the market was. That same accounting firm, like, couldn't get on stage, couldn't get on your pod if they paid, you know, at this point. And back then they were just like, yeah, you can use our space, but we're not showing up. And you know, that was the fintech community.
Yeah. I mean, I had a very similar sort of story. I mean, I, you know, spent the majority of the first half of my career in the advertising technology space, which was obviously big in New York as well. And then I started investing some of my own personal money in the early peer-to-peer lending platforms and sort of building out some models to sort of, you know, make better sort of predictions.
And this wasn't like angel investing. This was like using their platforms to do investing.
Yeah, yeah, no, this is me with the Prosper and Lending Club login, you know. Mm-hmm. It's downloading the like loan tapes and just having fun with it, you know. and anyway, I'd seen the rise of Meetup in New York. And I was like, this is an interesting idea that there's sort of like this SaaS business that's focused on sort of like building communities. And so I was like sitting around with my partner being like, what community should I start? Right. Because I had sort of been the attendee and I sort of wanted to see, you know, part of me was the product side of me was curious what their sort of host platform looked like, you know, and how they interacted and drove sort of content. So I started the peer-to-peer lending meetup. And I scheduled it at the bar across the street from my apartment because I was like, if no one shows up, I just go have a drink with my bartender and like we hang out and it's not a big deal. And then every single month, more people showed up. It was sort of, that's when I sort of was like, oh, there's something happening here, right? Like no one is, to your point, no one was throwing around huge sponsorship dollars or sort of, you know, really putting carrots in front of people's faces to sort of lead them into this space. It was a lot of people who were just like curious, you know, and I think that's sort of the common theme amongst a lot of us.
So, you know, other than having people actually pay for your Pizza Now, perhaps even better meals than Pizza Now, what's kept you in the fintech space? Like, why is this still so exciting? And each of you have had so many different forays and met so many people while here. And, you know, you've stuck around and you could easily go do something else with your skill set as well. Like mechanical engineering goes to other things. Matt, angel invest, like he could invest in other things and stuff too. But you all just seem stuck in fintech. What's kept you here?
I put all the money, in my bank that all three of us ask us this question once a week at least. And so we're going to give a really shiny answer because this is TWIF and you're brilliant, but there's just no question that we don't sort of before we're caffeinated grunt at ourselves and say, what the heck are we still doing in fintech? But no, I'll give you,
you know, there's some seriousness to that, but I'll also give you a more serious answer from my side. And you know, that truly is the opportunity to support someone's dream and to support the underdog. And those are things that just highly motivate me. And correlated to that is that technology and financial services hasn't been inclusive. And there are brilliant entrepreneurs from outside of the coast that maybe don't look like us that are building really interesting things and maybe haven't had that opportunity to support not only themselves, but their families. So for me, it's all driven by thousands of founders that could go to a bank and make 10x what they're making today. And instead they say, you know what, forget it. I'm going to eat ramen noodle. I'm going to work in a co-working space. I'm going to have five roommates in Bed-Stuy because I'm going to do something that everyone said couldn't be done. And, you know, if they're getting up before their alarm to work on this and hack on this, you be damn sure that I'm going to get up and do everything I can to pull the community together and pull resources together for the folks in the arena. So anyway, little long-winded, but that's absolutely what keeps me in fintech and I guess in the entrepreneurship / innovation ecosystem, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think the network of founders has to be a big part of it. I mean, what I've come to appreciate about fintech is it's super complicated. Like even defining what the word means.
No, Matt, come on. Everything is fintech. It has to be simple.
Correct. But every time I like sort of think that I have sort of conquered the major pillars that we sort of bucket in financial technology, I find another little space, right? That is sort of, you know, a big, huge, important cog of how the financial system works that like I was completely unaware of and has like, you know, it's just like sort of like the choose your own adventure novels, right? Like it just seems that there's always the next adventure right now. Now, who knows? Maybe in 5 years, we'll be talking about how we've sort of like, you know, fintech is sort of in, you know, wiggled its way into every single space. But I sort of doubt it because, you know, at the moment, there's sort of a big transition where a lot of the what we call traditional fintech people are now pushing themselves more and more into the crypto space. And I think that that's just going to like open up sort of a whole new playing field as sort of we have more sort of real world assets sort of being reflected in sort of that new ecosystem. So I think there's like another 15 years to build. Now, the real question I have is fintech and VC a good marriage? In that regard, I would say no, right? Like the verdict has been, it hasn't been a good asset class for VC, but that's fine, right? Like traditionally it was more private equity that funded it. It was a lot of bootstrapped businesses. It was a lot of strategic investors that came in. So I think fintech can be fine with fintech VC not being fine is sort of the message on that.
Hi, fintech friends. Okay, mark your calendars for the event happening during New York Fintech Week, the 2024 Empire Fintech Conference. Picture this, a day jam-packed with masterclasses, live demos, inspiring keynotes, riveting live podcasts, and unparalleled networking opportunities. Join over 700 attendees, myself included, on Wednesday, April 10th, and immerse yourself at the forefront of fintech innovation. As a special treat to our listeners, aka you, you can use code FintechOG for 15% off at checkout. Just go to empirestartups.com to grab your ticket today. So when you guys got into fintech, I love asking this question, because especially when you've been in it for, you know, a decade plus, what's something they thought, you know, by 2024, like fintech, it's got this, we're good, and it just hasn't materialized yet?
I mean, that's an awesome question. I want to go back to, you know, can VCs help fintech, and what do VCs make in this market? I think now is a really interesting time because thousands of LPs are about to not get paid for funds they invested in 2020 and 2021, and we're divesting in some verticals that I'm still wildly optimistic about. I'm sure the two of you are also wildly optimistic about it. We're divesting because the market had too much capital and companies blew up, not necessarily because we invalidated that as an opportunity in the market. So anyway, and that'll also get spicy because we can throw some shade at VCs, right, Matt? The thing that I'd say, we could take the question all over the place. What I would say is really surprising is that we don't have any cohesive, intelligent policy from any of the last three administrations. You know, 2010 to 2015, I just can't believe it.
The fact that so few regulators can find their way to an Amtrak station to come to New York to find out what's actually happening in financial services and fintech is just mind-boggling. It's honestly just, you know, throwing feces at big evil banks and accomplishing nothing. So sorry for the soapbox, but I think the regulatory environment or specifically policy out of the administration's been a huge surprise.
I mean, I think that's spot on. I mean, if you look at sort of the quality of the fintech apps, let's just put it, whether it's a small business or a consumer, you've seen way more progress if you're a Brazilian, right? Or whether if you're from the UK or Canada than you have in the US. And the issue has not been technology, nor has it been capital to build these systems. It's been the regulators who just make it incredibly difficult to navigate. And part of it's on purpose, right? Like we have a culture of sort of the regulation is one that they want to, it's sort of by enforcement. So we sort of have to wait until the SEC goes after somebody to sort of know what the laws are on a go forward basis. And like, that's very difficult because those court cases take years. I mean, if you look, you know, basically we didn't get an ETF in Bitcoin for a decade because we were just waiting for the court system to finally rule on it. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's one. And then, you know, the other one I think about a lot, and mainly just because I'm very involved in a bunch of early stage businesses, is just how hard it is to get banking relationships. I mean, these are like fintech experts, well capitalized, everything, like we should be able to open up a bank account, right, to be able to do basic sort of stuff for our customers. And the hoops that you have to jump through with banking as a service or the big banks, is the friction is just crazy.
Is that more banking, interesting, innovative companies, Matt? Or are you talking specifically about borrowing a charter to launch bank financial products? Do you mean like a fintech partnering with a bank, borrowing their charter, so to speak, so that they can distribute financial products? Are you talking more just micro businesses in general and how much of a pain in the ass financial services and fintech is for them?
I mean, both, but I was mainly focused. Yeah, I was mainly focused. The comment was more focused on, let's say that you have an innovative payments sort of business that you want to do, right? And you've identified supply chain or sort of the growth of the U.S.-Mexico trade, et cetera, right? And you want to sort of plug in and sort of a B2B2B and plug into logistics people and help them move money and sort of just track their businesses better and run their businesses. Like a huge portion of that is like, can you get through the gauntlet of being able to open up one of these parent-child bank accounts, right? Yeah. And largely what we've seen in the last decade, I think, is we had this hypothesis that, you know, the fintechs were going to partner with the small banks and they were going to take market share from the big banks. And then the big banks were going to have to react because they were losing market share. Well, most of the small banks are no longer around, right? Like Silicon Valley Bank is gone and many of the other sort of their kind have disappeared. And then the guys who are left as the banking as a service, you know, are very, very cautious right now. Like at the moment, they're worried about losing sort of the regulatory pressure is very high. So onboarding new customers is sort of like the lowest priority they have at the moment. And it's just sort of stifling innovation. Like, again, right? It's, you know, I look and it's just, I was very wrong. Like JP Morgan ended up having an amazing 10 years from, you know, 2014 to 2024. You know, I didn't have that in my cards when I got into this space.
There's a lot of things that have happened in fintech that we did not have on our bingo cards.
Exactly.
You know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, where is something where fintech might have exceeded your expectations from when you joined the space?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the thing that I'm like most excited about that it's being adopted is the access to earned wages. Right. Like this whole idea that you sort of work for an employer and they hold your money for a period of time. Right. Sort of as an interest free loan to the company. And then for a lot of these people who are under financial stress and sort of trying to piece together friends and family before they can sort of hit their paycheck. And, you know, in the US, we're lucky because we get paid every 2 weeks for the most part, but the rest of the world is not like that. It's once a month, you know? And so I really do think that in that category, I've just been pleasantly surprised at the ability to sort of create a new way of sort of letting people access their real-time wages. You know, this was really pioneered by the Ubers of the world, right? But now it's sort of spreading everywhere. And then the second piece is like there was a sustainable business model that could be created, right? These companies are actually profitable, unlike a lot of fintechs that, you know, did do good but couldn't figure out how to make money. And then the third piece is that, and its distribution channel, the employer actually wants to add it as an employee benefit. You know, so it seems to be one of those rare ones that sort of like all the parties sort of agreed that somebody new had to come in to stitch everything together to sort of provide this benefit. So there's that one that I'm sort of excited about. And then on the peer-to-peer lending side, you know, my view on that is like the SEC just destroyed the space in the U.S. Right. It was like we were moving towards a space in which we were sort of making the loan, individual loan, more and more transparent and more sort of liquid in the ability to trade it. And we basically got told by the SEC that like they were going to come after anyone who did that for securities law, where for the, you know, vast majority of the history of the U.S., loans are not securities. So it was a hyper-aggressive stance that they sort of took on that side. And when they took that stance, then all of a sudden there was no sort of path forward for all these guys. And so Lending Club got their bank, you know, and SoFi got a bank. They went the traditional route. Now, I think what we're seeing, though, is that they're not very good companies on the traditional side, right? Like once they start to have to sort of like act exactly like a bank, their competitive advantage is way down. And so if you look at sort of the stocks, you know, there's a whole group of people who all went public and then lost 90% of their sort of market cap, you know, in the first 6 months. And I just think that that's the problem is that if you have to compete against the incumbents on their own turf, it's incredibly difficult still to today. You know,
and anyone in or out of your portfolio on the EWA side that you're excited about?
I mean, honestly, like, I'm excited about all of them, right? So I was involved with, like, Rain in
you
the
want
U.S.
an EWA ETF? Is that what, is that the next business that you're going to launch?
Yeah, I would be one of the biggest. So there's Rain in the U.S., which I was very involved with, sort of the founding. Then there was Minu in Mexico that I was very involved with. And then I've known the WageStream guys in Europe since they've started the business as well and have loved what they're working on. And then obviously DailyPay has sort of been the one in the U.S. that sort of gets the most press. They had a huge fundraise just yesterday, right? And it looks like they're going to be a big IPO candidate. They say 2025, but my guess is they're just ready to go as soon as the markets sort of open back up.
Yeah. Can you tell us what you're doing yet, Matt, or no? Is this still a secret? Because I think you should spill the beans on this podcast.
That's why we're here. No. That's why I'm here, Matt.
I mean, I wish I had sort of a super sexy answer to this and there was a big reveal that was going on. But I realized sort of I didn't take a break at Orchard. So it was sort of like 5.5 years without a break. And then I didn't really take a break when I joined QED. And then I started sort of incubating companies there and working on special opportunities. And I found myself sort of just being like, wait a minute, like I'm just sort of being pulled in a direction. I'm not being mindful of like, is this the direction that I need to be going? Right. Back to that earlier question, we have the question of like, does this make sense for us to stay in fintech once a week? Right. I sort of had like a bigger moment in that time. And then as I sort of reflected, I said, well, okay, well, I need to sort of not do anything proactively for a period of time in order to sort of have some mental clarity around it. And so that's sort of like last year, I tried to just not sign up for anything full time. But the beauty of it was, you know, there was plenty of work for me to do because there's tons of stress in the system. There's a lot of founders who want help raising equity, raising debt. They're in an M&A process and like their board is not working for them anymore. And so they're just looking for somebody to sort of come in and help. And so between sort of my existing portfolio companies that I was very close with, as well as sort of a lot of my network, you know, it's like I found myself like, oh, wow, I have sort of total full plate just helping these people out. But going forward, like this is my big question, right? Like I got pitched my first CEO role that I was like, ooh, I might actually consider that. Just last week, you know, and it's like, I still wait for that idea that keeps me up at night. But now I know how hard it is. Like I've now watched at least 20 founders like up close, like where I've been a part of every single major decision they've made in fintechs. And I just know it's a very difficult path. It's much, much easier to build an AI company or to like, you know, build, you know, in other spaces because you just don't have the regulatory complexity, because you don't have the capital intensity of a lot of these models, right? Like they're fintech, there's just a lot more ways to die. So like I have those scars. And so I want to make sure that like if I do
more sort of, ways to die.
It's true, though.
At
Orchard in 2016, like very few people know, but we lost 50% of our customers in a 6-month period, all lenders. And like they found the most creative ways to blow themselves up. There was not a single one that was the same way that they ended up doing it. You know, some had issues in servicing and data quality issues, and some had issues in marketing, and some had like, you know, internal fights amongst the executives, and some debt providers got pulled. Like it's just there. Again, startups are hard, right? You need everything to go right for you. And it's like, unfortunately, like in the fintech world, you need like, you know, it's not three things to go right. You need like 5 or 6 to go right in a row. And so it's just, again, I think that it's why the sort of prize is bigger. It's why people are sort of drawn to it because it's harder.
I love that from like the outsider, you see all these like successful exits and you just assume like there were no big things that happened in there. There's not a single founder that I've talked to from PayPal to Aaron Frank, who built Final, which is now the Apple credit card, to Matt at Orchard, to whoever you name it, where there wasn't a point where they thought, like many points where they thought it just wasn't going to work out.
Yeah.
And tied into, you know, why I'm still in fintech and why I'm still supporting entrepreneurs. It just comes down to what do you, you know, not to get too dramatic, but what do you want on your deathbed? I want to have taken every shot, taken every chance. Taking big swings and, you know, failed miserably along the way. And again, if anyone's in the arena and working on that, I'm going to support it. But I think to your point, not only has every successful company hit road bumps, I mean, I've been on board meetings, I've been, you know, a millimeter from top fintech companies today. I've been in board meetings where they were a millimeter from shutting down and paying back capital. You know, this year, sorry for the plug, but Empire Fintech Week is April 8th to the 12th, and the conference is April 10th. I mean, we have unicorn and decacorn founders that were already getting wiring instructions together to pay back capital before they hit some inflection point. And that's a difficult journey. You know, you're signing up to do something incredible, and you have a 0.01% chance of success. Is the reality of entrepreneurship. Yeah. I mean, back to your point, Matt, just really quick on the EWA side. I mean, I like that because it's actually an unpopular opinion. EWA can be polarizing. A lot of folks, and I've been one of them, I go out and say, I'd rather figure out how to help consumers save money than spend money. The other thing that I'll go out and say is there's a lot of analog markets or not real-time markets, and entrepreneurs, of course, intuitively as technologists who say, let's digitize this, let's digitize alts and digitize, you know, every aspect of capital markets. And the reality is there's not enough demand. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit that I simply was wrong about the opportunity for EWA. It's exploded. And probably the takeaway for entrepreneurs is make sure you state the obvious, talking to customers, really understand that demand. Don't digitize some product or service just because it should be digitized and it's done in an analog fashion today. So anyway, kudos to you for your spicy and unpopular opinion / John Zanoff was wrong about EWA.
Well, I mean, just to finish that thought, I mean, the thing, and we didn't know this until we were already live, right? So back to this whole thing of like, you have to jump into deep end before you have the data on whether the thing's going to work or not. But when I knew EWA was going to work was when we saw that employees who checked how much they were making on a daily basis would pick up extra shifts and be on time more than non-employees. And so there was not just the digitization of the data, of the payroll data and the timekeeping data, but it was actually when you allow someone to know what their net earnings is on a per day basis, it helps them financially plan better. Right.
Yeah.
It's not just like, do I want to pick up an overtime shift on Saturday? They can know exactly what that means to, in their pocket. And so for me, it was less about sort of the pure access point on, you know, somebody who had an emergency, their car broke down or this or that and needed to withdraw. But what you see in the behavior was the withdrawals are a relatively small portion of the entire employee base every month. But the number of active users who are just using this as a financial tool to help plan was actually very high. And the cool part about that is if you have those eyeballs, if you're the money button on the phone for the employees and you know, for them checking their employer data, then you can cross sell. And that's what like Menu has like been and done an amazing job in Mexico with, is all of a sudden you're at the point in which you can offer all these other employee benefits via that real estate. And for me, like, I don't know how you guys have felt on employee benefits, but like they have never felt accessible to me. It's always like a pitch that the HR person says that like you have to go hunt down, you know, is there a mental health portion or is there sort of savings on X, Y, and Z or this or discounts? And my view was it was always going to end up on an app, right? It's always going to end up on somebody's phone at some point, you know. And but yeah, I mean, I think that this is the type of conversation. It's like what went well and what didn't go well, what was surprising, what was not surprising, right? I think that it's funny we actually can have perspective. I think if you had asked us 2 years ago, we would have all said like, you know, that like fintech was going to the moon. You know?
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I've always liked to have a bit of realism in mixed in with my wild optimism about fintech. But it's an interesting take on EWA. Thanks for that.
All right, so we're coming up on our fun round, and I want this to not be work-related, and it's quick fire. So, Matt, what has been a personal highlight from the past year? And we'll say personal highlight from 2023, because we're only a couple weeks into 24.
Yeah, I became a dad in 2023.
Oh, congrats. That's so exciting. Yes. I didn't know that. Boy or girl?
It's a boy, Oliver.
Oh, I love that name. So cute. And you would be slammed by your wife if you did not name becoming a dad as your highlight from the past year then. John, what about you?
the same. It just happens to be that I'm a dog dad. I have a 13-month-old beautiful baby kitty girl that is the center of our universe. I'd say the other thing on the personal side, my wife did take first place at New Jersey Spartan Ultra. So if you've ever run 35 miles up and down a mountain, you can compete in a Spartan Ultra. And not only
I'm just going to let her take that one. Yeah. I have no interest in doing that.
Not only has she done it, but she's been on.
She's very good at it, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely. Two highlights.
Cool. All right, John, question for you this time. First, if you could have dinner with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be?
Oh, man, we just had this. This is like a, first date topics, whatever, or, networking topics. And just sort of laughing at it and, who you'd want to break bread with. There are a lot of people, but if I'm only picking one, I'll pick one that no one's going to take, which is Keanu Reeves. He's like he's my guy. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk motorcycles and guns and man stuff.
I feel like he would be a pretty good dinner guest. I feel like that's probably a good choice. Matt, what about
and
you?
Nothing, and not talking about fintech at fucking all. You can edit that one as needed.
Yeah, I mean, I'll do a fintech one. Like, I would probably want to have dinner with SPF. I have been following sort of like that whole FTX craziness from the beginning. And I know he's in jail, so it's going to be difficult for me to have dinner with him, but I'm so curious. Like, I have so many questions for how that played out and what actually went down, I think it's interesting because now it looks like the estate is going to actually pay back everything close to par.
It's crazy.
When it's all said and done. And, I was told at the beginning by a bunch of people that the exact same thing happened at Lehman. That like Lehman at the beginning, everyone thought was 30 cents on the dollar, and it ended up when everything was paid off. Even after, if you've looked at the bankruptcy fees that the lawyers are taking, like after they've charged FTX's estate $1.5 billion, beyond that, it looks like there's a chance that everybody would make.
That you've done so much research on this. I'm learning things. back to Matt for the first one. When you're having a hard time, who's your first person that you're going to call? Who's your 911 list?
Oh, man. So I deal with this a lot with founders. We're in a high stress environment. You need your outlets, right? What I have realized is that my outlet is actually not hopping on the phone and talking to people, right? Everyone's different. For me, the only thing that could sort of relieve enough stress that would allow me to sleep was I needed to be in a really hot sauna or a really hot shower or bath. Like, I physically needed to exhaust myself in order to be able to go to bed. So that was my coping mechanism on all of that stuff. For other people, it is like they call coaches, they call parents, they call other people. But for me, like my talking about it more would just make it spin faster in my head and my subconscious. And what I actually needed to do was unwind the thing in order to think clearly. And so, for each founder that I work with, we always figure out what is your sort of release valve. Could be going skiing or snowboarding, right? Or it could be going on a road trip, or could playing guitar. Like, you need to identify it ahead of time and know sort of what that safe place is, because you will get to the point of sort of like a nervous breakdown and you're going to have to sort of, not go down that path.
John.
That's a good answer, Julie. Can we stop there? I guess not. So, related is, from a mental health and headspace standpoint, very, very similar. I think I'm on 30 straight years of working out 6 days a week. And if I don't have that consistency, those endorphins, and those chemicals to just overall lower anxiety and stave off depression, I'm in a bad spot to be candid. And I can predict that, the only good news is I can absolutely predict those weeks. It's as simple as was I able to do something physical. But as far as phone a friend, I definitely have other, Gen Xers tends to be Gen X CEOs. CEOs are just a very lonely spot. Entrepreneurship is a lonely spot. Folks who won't judge and understand the reality that once a week you're in an existential crisis and you're wondering if you're focused on the right things, if you're working hard enough, if you're nurturing relationships that you need to be nurturing along the way. It's very, very difficult. Those, those are folks like Neil Gnu of Finch or Lawrence Latimer and Ron J. Williams from Denara and from Venture Studio. I mean, those are folks that are just on my Rolodex. But the quick,
this is the lightning and fun round. It would be other CEOs in the space that just understand the loneliness of it.
So, final question, and John, we're back to you answering first. What's something about you that no one could find out from the internet?
Oh man, I'm internally grateful that growing up we didn't have camera phones and video phones. That's like the. You want to talk about like millennials versus Gen X, there's no incriminating evidence from when I was in university. I don't think, at least not on anyone's phone.
I'm
a big baker. I think that surprises people. I have a cheesecake that'll knock your socks off and no one's going to pick John Zanoff as winning a bake sale, but I think I've won the baking competition at every company I've ever worked in and will continue to do so. So definitely a sweet tooth, and we'd rather have an apron on perhaps than be sitting in front of a terminal coding for fintech.
Yeah, I mean, well, first off, having the name Matt Burton, it's like very difficult for anyone to find information on me because it's such a common name. And I've realized that that's like, at first I was sort of bummed about that. And now I've realized it's actually a good thing, like at the end of the day. Something that people wouldn't know about me is, we ended up with a flock of sheep. And so now, in addition to the full-time shepherd, I help out, with that, in the Hudson Valley. And, we had a husky come visit and, basically just beelined it towards the sheep and jumped over and wrecked the whole thing. And the sheep all spilled out onto the main highway. And so then I was like having to help a bunch of people sort of herd them back in. And we thought we had done it successfully. And then all of a sudden we counted them and we were missing one. And so we ended up, as a massive group tracking into the woods, following the tracks because the snow was fresh, and then finding the sheep and then realizing like, it doesn't matter if you have six people, like catching a sheep is like incredibly difficult.
Did you name that sheep Norman?
Exactly. We definitely looked at the tag and we finally caught it. That was, for me, it's always been like our digital lives are just, and now with remote and everything, it's so very easy to sort of make that sort of all of work and stuff. And like, I'm always trying to figure out some way to bring it back to a physical space where building a structure, repairing something physical, dealing with animals, it doesn't need to be a huge portion of my life, but I've realized that, I have a higher quality of life if I can do that every now and then. And I feel like sort of baking is the same way. Like you're doing stuff with your hands to some degree, and it's like not just writing emails and typing on laptops.
So if there's one thing I take away from our conversation is that in order to not lose your mind as a fintech founder, you need to have a herd of sheep. Is that what I'm getting?
Yeah, and be a baker.
And be a baker. Perfect. Well, thank you so much, you guys. I'm really excited for this episode to come on out as well as the other episodes. I'm having trouble figuring out which one I want, like what the order is, because I want all of them to just go out at once and be in the universe. But thank you so much again. I know you both are very busy baking or herding sheep or, being very successful in the fintech space, all of the above. So I appreciate you taking the time today.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks for having us. Yeah, we'll see you in April for New York Fintech Week.
There we go. Don't forget about it, guys.
I'll see you there. Bye.